This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombeWealth.com.
Welcome to our Texas edition of Party Politics, a podcast to prep you for all things political in this wonderful state we call home. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Well, Jay, we are definitely weeks away from the Christmas season, but Greg Abbott has a little bit of Christmas spirit to send our way. So what is happening with the Christmas decision?
Well, the Christmas decision, right? Yeah, Christmas in October, all right? We haven't even gotten to Halloween or Thanksgiving, but we're gonna talk Christmas anyway.
Well, now like all the stores have got Christmas stuff, right?
Exactly.
Like they skipped over all the other holidays.
We keep moving back. Right. Well, Brandon, about 2 years ago, there was a mock nativity display, a secular display of the holiday spirit, so to speak, that was set up in the Texas Capitol. Governor Abbott decided that it was mocking Christianity and decided to pull it. Well, they took him to court, and fast forward 2 years, he lost, and that was a violation of separation of church and state.
This has been an ongoing battle between the people that the Republicans say are not engaging enough in the Christmas spirit and in saying things like Merry Christmas.
Is this the war on Christmas?
We're in the middle of this war, Jay, on Christmas. So here we have Governor Abbott, Abbott Claus, coming to provide the Christmas spirit. This is a legal battle, so it's interesting, but it's also clearly political. The governor called it a juvenile parody. This actually included founding fathers, it included the Statue of Liberty and the Bill of Rights in the place of the baby Jesus in the manger. So it was clearly meant to be a political interaction, and Governor Abbott, at least at the moment, seems to have gotten on the losing side of this.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation these days about freedom of speech, freedom of expression. This is pretty much right down the middle, exactly what the First Amendment is supposed to be about. Obviously, the court agreed with that view and disagreed with the governor. I think the governor was just playing politics. I think we recognize that that's protected speech. The governor, I think, was trying to make a larger point to his political base. He made the point, legal recourse took over, and it's now done.
Hey, speaking of political bases, it looks like Donald Trump is pretty popular here in Texas, especially with Republicans. This is a little bit surprising, honestly, considering all of the friction that's happened in the past, 8 months that he's been president.
Yeah, exactly. There was a new set of polls coming out of UT and Texas Tribune that basically said that President Trump has tremendous favorables among Republicans. As you might expect, about 92% of Democrats don't like him. And so that's sort of offsetting it, and he's still not doing as well as you would expect. But Republicans are very much in his corner and standing tall. But what I want to talk about, Brandon, is the hot political story that's going around right now, and that's Brandon Rottinghouse versus Beto O'Rourke. So let me break this down for our listeners. Right now, we're in a fundraising mode, and the fundraising wrap-up has been going on where Beto O'Rourke, the challenger to Ted Cruz, has called into question your bona fides, Brandon, in predicting that he couldn't be competitive without taking PAC money.
Yeah, I had given comments to the El Paso Times. Your reporter Madeline Meckelberg wrote a nice story about the kind of roundup of where things are in the Senate race, and apparently the O'Rourke team didn't like the fact that I said that them winning without PAC money and or raising about $50 million was going to be impossible. I still think that this is a tough race. Maybe impossible was too far to go, but it's going to be near impossible, if nothing else. In fact, these polls that we saw that we were just referenced with respect to Trump say that 70% of Texans do not have an opinion about Beto O'Rourke. That is a difficult road to climb. And it is, to quote a famous song, the river is wide and the trail is long for Beto O'Rourke. So I don't know how he's going to overcome that, especially if it's the case that they're not going to be able to raise more than Ted Cruz and or in the neighborhood of, $50, $60 million.
I mean, this to me is a lot of semantics on wanting to say I'm not taking PAC money, because by all accounts, there are super PACs in favor of Beto O'Rourke. And there's going to be an entirely independent expenditure campaign in favor of Beto O'Rourke. So yeah. I think this is a lot of posturing for his base that he is pure in not taking PAC money, but I think he's doing an end run around it. So I think until we see those total numbers, we won't know. But The bigger issue is he just has a long way to go to define himself, and he needs to do it before Ted Cruz defines himself.
Yeah, and the problem is that, you know, you're not going to take PAC money, but then the PAC money is going to be spent on your behalf. So you're getting essentially the same criticism if you had taken it, and you're not getting the benefit of having the money. So I think it's a kind of lose-lose. We've seen lots of races like this. It's admirable that you don't want to take this PAC money, but I don't think politically it matters because people don't care about that process.
Well, Brandon, you know, we were talking about the popularity of President Trump. One of the Republican office holders who is probably least popular in our state right now is our Attorney General Ken Paxton. But in his actual day job, they're doing a lot of important things as it relates to price gouging in the aftermath of Harvey. What's going on there?
Yeah, actually, a lot of people don't recognize that the AG isn't just like in court. They do a lot of things that are independent of court. In particular, one of the things they do is that they investigate claims of price gouging or exorbitant prices, especially in the aftermath of a disaster. So the Texans have lodged about 3,000 complaints against hundreds of various businesses after Harvey. As of last week, there are only 82 investigations into these companies and 3 lawsuits being filed. Does this mean that they're understaffed? Does it mean that they're not attentive? I think politically it's a risk because you cannot be in a position where you aren't helping people after this major disaster. So they really have to, as a political ploy, but also as an administrative issue, fix this.
Little known fact, one of my first jobs was in the Consumer Protection Division
Wow, okay.
Of the Attorney General's office. So yeah, absolutely. They do.
So people should email us and tell you.
Yes. They should tell me what's, you know,
overpriced
fruit. Exactly. And I will solve all your problems. Hardly. But no, you're absolutely right. Price gouging is a huge issue. Contact the Attorney General, let them deal with it. That consumer element of it, I think, is often lost, but it's a protective device there. Same thing actually can happen locally. The Harris County Attorney's Office can deal with that if you're in Harris County or any of the county attorneys that are affected by consumer fraud.
This is great news you can use, right? We are helping you, yeah, in your everyday life, right? Tell a friend, right?
Exactly. Let's keep with our Attorney General because we were talking a little bit about him, but he has led this effort nationally, sort of pushing back against the undocumented here. He's against undocumented immigration, but he's also been vehemently against abortion rights. And so we've had this case that came up. Tell us about that.
This is a case that results from a pregnant undocumented teenager who was in federal custody and requested an abortion. There's lots of details that are unseemly about what happened. Put on both sides, and it's problematic in that it was unclear whether or not Texas law would allow for her to terminate her pregnancy. The current incarnation has been that the court has allowed that this was something that she is entitled to. So it is a blow for Ken Paxton, and like you say, a political problem for the Republicans, but potentially a political, I don't know, kind of gold lining, right, where they have been so adamant against abortion and so adamant against undocumented immigration, but now you have it all in one. So if there's an issue that's going to really stimulate the base, it's this, the confluence of these two things that they have been fighting against for decades.
The issue, I think, is not going to go away. This is going to continue on. But I think for Ken Paxton, again, the more he does issues like this and dealing with issues like this and less about sort of the larger universal elements of the Attorney General's office dealing with consumer protection and fraud, I think is bad for him politically because, again, we're shifting gears and he has been so polarizing and we're getting to the point now where we might start seeing some challengers and that on the Democratic side, it might be a very interesting challenger coming up.
Yeah, and speaking of challengers, we know that Joaquin Castro is a pretty solid hold on his district outside San Antonio, but former U.S. Representative Francisco Canseco is filed paperwork to take him on. Canseco was a former member. He has had 6 campaigns in 3 different districts in 8 different cycles. So he's like a Johnny Cash song, I've been everywhere. He doesn't seem like he's going to have much of a chance to be able to unseat Castro in a very Democratic district.
Gerrymandering has made this district almost impossible for a Republican to be successful in. Joaquin Castro has nothing to worry about. The only way Joaquin Castro loses that district is if he doesn't run. And it turns out, if he doesn't run, it looks like he might be. We know that he looked at the governor's race, passed on it, but it looks like he might be thinking about running for Attorney General, challenging Ken Paxton.
That would be really huge, right? I think that Paxton is the weakest of the herd for the Republicans statewide. And if Castro can get a foothold for the Democrats, it would be big, big news.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense for Joaquin on multiple levels. Number one, as you said, Paxson is the weakest. He's the least popular among the Republican incumbent statewide office holders. This is a major office, sort of the third office after governor and lieutenant governor statewide. Many of the issues that Joaquin Castro is most identified with, particularly as it relates to immigrants, and particularly as it relates to some of the other social issues that the Democratic base get charged up about, Ken Paxton is on the other side and sort of leading the charge. It's sort of been traditionally been the springboard for running for governor or U.S. senator. It is a major office. It would be a major move, I think. Ken Paxton's not that well known either, and he also doesn't have a lot of money. And oh, I forgot, he's got a criminal case pending.
Whoops, turns out he's under indictment. It's not going to go away either before that filing deadline, so we'll see how that plays out. Well, Jay, we've had other kind of dust-ups this week. Texas Representative Jason Villalba, who's a representative from Dallas, called a conservative blogger, quote, butt bloat, unquote, and an oafish fat doofus on Twitter. Obviously, this is exactly the place for such insults, right? Twitter is the perfect place to happen. This blogger had apparently called Villalba a, quote, candy jar watcher in reference to the candy jar that sits on his desk that he distributes candy to, which I think is a great PR move, especially, you know, trying to make friends in the legislature. Obviously, Villalba apologized, and this issue went away, but it has become a bit of kind of passé to have this Republican-on-Republican violence, and we've seen it so many times, and we're no doubt going to see it again.
Yeah, the coarseness of the language, I think, is what makes it kind of funny, right? I mean, you're talking about a situation, although, as we were reminded, it's never a good idea and never appropriate to comment on someone's weight.
Nope, he wouldn't do that, tell his kids to do that, so...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Don't do it.
And it's not in the same way, it's certainly not as colorful, but there's a pretty interesting dust-up going on between Houston State Representative Sarah Davis and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. A real flap over Harvey relief-related events. Representative Davis had filed a bill that allowed for the reappraisal of storm-damaged property. It had passed unanimously in the House and got stuck in the Senate. And Lieutenant Governor Patrick essentially pushed back, arguing that she was only interested in supporting a bill that had her name on it, and that as a member of the leadership, she did not want to support a Senate version of it. What he forgot to mention is she did it both during the regular session and the specials. There was never a bill from the Senate during the special. And so this is one that's not going away, but Sarah Davis pushing back hard against the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, there's always been friction there. She's a moderate member, which reflects her district. Again, this is going to be this sort of ongoing civil war between the parties. It's personal, but it's also political. And it's going to make it hard for them to come together if they really ever need it. I don't think they will, because they pretty much dominate elections and likely will do so in 18. But when they need things to rally in 2020, that's going to be, I think, where we see some of these fissures really play out. And of course, there's some races where you're having Republicans challenge from the center. I don't know that those are going to play out and they're going to be successful, but the fact that that's happening shows that there's a real backlash to this.
Speaking of the center, Democrats may finally have a gubernatorial candidate. Brandon, we're going to break a little news here, but Andrew White, the son of the late Governor Mark White, who's a Houston area businessman, a venture capitalist here, is apparently going to file for office in the next week or two to challenge Greg Abbott. So we'll get some news hopefully very soon on that. But we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk a little about Ted Cruz, our favorite U.S. senator. He's got some Republican challengers, and some of them are kind of interesting.
Well, so, Jay, we've talked a lot about the politics of what's happening in the state, and it is no surprise that we're going to have some interesting challenges to Senator Cruz. So who in the grand scheme of Texas politics is cruising for a challenge?
Exactly, right? So we were talking about this before. Ted Cruz is not entirely loved in the state of Texas, even among Republicans, but he's got three challengers, or two and a half right now. Let's say two and a half, because we know the last one's not official, but it's pretty close.
You got to get signatures, you got to pay your filing fee. So
exactly, and it's sort of interesting because you're getting him from kind of both sides. So he's got an interesting challenger, so kind of from the left to center, an energy lawyer with the interesting name of Stefano Di Stefano. And I'm not making that up. That's literally his name, his first name and his last name. He's challenging him really from as a centrist, arguing that he's forgotten what's going on in terms of Texas energy, Texas business, and he's outside the mainstream. He's also got challenged by Dan McQueen. Now, Dan McQueen famously was the mayor of Corpus Christi, lasted all of 37 days in office. I guess the pressures of running Corpus were too great for him, and he's decided he wants to be a U.S. senator. And finally, I think the name that probably creates the most annoyance for Ted Cruz, just from a political base perspective, is Bruce Jacobson. He's a producer for a Christian cable TV network and has a, I think, Texans for Texas PAC is supporting him. He's already got some institutional support, folks that are advocating for him. And ostensibly, he's going to be attacking Cruz, I guess, from the right, although I'm not sure how anyone can really get to the right of Ted Cruz.
That's a good question. We've got, you know, a couple of challengers from different areas, but I don't think, first of all, off the top, any of them have much of a chance to unseat Ted Cruz, right? I mean, don't you think that's the way
yeah,
to think about this?
Yeah, absolutely.
To start at where you started, Stefano DeStefano is an energy lawyer, no political experience. He calls himself a free market conservative. He thinks that Ted Cruz is too divisive and that he's too much in favor of Ted Cruz as opposed to being in favor of Texas. He also disagrees with Cruz on immigration issues. So he strikes me as a kind of traditional conservative in the mold of Joe Strauss without getting too deep into some of the specifics. So that's probably a more centrist challenge to Cruz. Dan McQueen is an unusual candidate, like you say. He was the mayor of Corpus Christi for 37 days, and some of the things that were questioned during that period made him a little uncomfortable, and so he decided to essentially walk away. He is currently trying to raise money by selling a building and have a contest, which is, he calls the McQueen Motorcycle Cafe Essay and Rib Contest. I have never seen such interesting trends in campaign fundraising as we've seen here. Will it work? I don't know. You make the point that Jacobson is really the one who is the most impressive. He wants to say essentially that Ted Cruz can't drive a peanut wagon. Like, he is
right,
not effective in the U.S. Senate. He worked for Ronald Reagan. He said he's tired of this political posturing. He's getting a little bit more press, but again, he also isn't necessarily jumping in the race. So there are, I think, various degrees of seriousness here, and also, I think, various degrees of competitiveness. None of them are likely to put much water in Ted Cruz's whiskey, who is probably going to win no matter what.
Absolutely. I think you're right about that. I mean, it is interesting. You would think that Cruz would be potentially ripe for a sort of a Trump-like challenge from someone not unlike sort of Roy Moore out of Alabama. But I'm not sure Bruce Jacobson fits that. He's a lot more of an establishment-oriented Republican than people recognize. He happens to work for a Christian cable system. And so that, I think, is what drives some of that. But that's a similar base. He's a lot like Ted Cruz in that, in from an ideological perspective. But the centrist argument is interesting because there's been a lot written about how Republicans in Texas, for whatever reason, there had been a history of being in favor of immigration reform and being in favor of free trade and NAFTA. That's really what the Texas Republican brand was. George Bush is the father of both those things. NAFTA and comprehensive immigration reform were his ideas. There's nobody carrying that mantle right now. It would be interesting to see if any of these guys ever got challenged from it, because right now you're seeing no pushback on those two issues from anyone at the statewide Republican leadership level.
Yeah, in an interview, Jacobson said that, you know, he wants to return to the kind of Reagan-era principles of trying to invoke some compromise. And so that's not something I think that modern Republicans really take to. So I don't know that that's going to be effective for him. And I think, to your point generally about Ted Cruz, he's been really effective at kind of walking both sides of this rope, where the Trump voters don't hate him, that the moderate voters don't hate him. He's not well-liked generally, but he hasn't run afoul of any of those groups so much so that they're going to not vote for him, especially when it comes to, like, a probably more painted liberal candidate like Beto O'Rourke. You know, Cruz can easily sort of suggest that he's too far outside of the mainstream for Texas, and that's going to be enough to get him the reelection support he needs. So again, I don't see where the challenge would come from here, and certainly none of these people, I think, are really legitimately able to unseat somebody powerful like Ted Cruz.
We'll take a quick break and we'll come back and we're going to tell you why we're talking about this.
So part of the reason this is important is because this is a competitive race and it's worth treating it like that. So if you're a voter, if you're somebody who's considering voting, there are options here. Go out and investigate. Make sure that you're well-informed when you vote. And above everything else, go and vote.
Well, we'll be back next week with more party politics. If you like this political chatter, make sure to check out our national politics episodes too. They're available every Friday afternoon, just like these episodes. As always, the show would not be possible without the help of Houston Public Media, our producer, Adele Howland, and our engineer extraordinaire, Big Audio Dynamite, Todd Holzlander.
If you haven't already, subscribe to us on iTunes or from wherever you get your podcast and leave us a review. It'll help other people find the show. Follow us on Twitter with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod and email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.